with Brandon. Brandon, hello.
Hello, Josh.
Brandon and me are going to throw on a pair of headphones. We're going to get into the zone. Brandon, how are you doing today?
Quite well, Josh. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
Nice.
Let's see what mic we got going on here. Okay, I think this should be good.
Yeah.
Okay, we're all set.
Okay,
Brandon,
great. Yeah.
Tell me what you're all about. Where are you coming from today? Are you coming from the photo sock?
Yes, I am, good sir. I'm I'm an exec on the photo sock. I'm the current darkroom manager because I do love film stuff. I was a darkroom manager last year, and we've been kind of like trying to get stuff going because the old version of our club was kind of torn down, unfortunately. So these past couple of years, I've been seeing it, you know, trying to come back up. And really, starting last year, we've started in a pretty good form again. We had some facilities, some sort of studio space, and I was able to set up a dark room too. Yeah, and this year we're doing pretty good too. Unfortunately, you know, as you know, we've been kicked out of our space again.
Right.
So, but you know, we've got a lot of good solutions still. We've been booking rooms in the Nest for studios. You know, I've got the members access to the visual arts dark room and everything.
Right.
So, it's going pretty well. Yeah.
Bring me back to the beginning. Let's rewind a bunch. When did the UBC Photo Society start?
Apparently, it was about, 1928 or something.
This may be a rumor, though. The 1928.
Yeah,
me and Brandon have been talking about
this. It's kind of like the official party line, I guess.
Right.
We kind of had, discussions, we're not totally sure. And I'm, for some reason, I can't get this, image in my head of, people with their big box cameras in the club for some reason. I don't know why. Why it seems kind of weird that it was that old. But, you know... Yeah, I'm sure they had some amateur camera clubs. There was always amateur camera clubs back then. So,
right.
It'd be really cool if it was that old, you know.
But since then, it's changed. It's been pretty consistent, though, since around that time, if it did start that early. I know it was active in the 60s.
I think we've been, hearing from people who were, actually recently we kind of got in touch with this guy who was, the president in the 70s or something. Yeah. I don't think any of our co-presidents have gotten the chance to talk to him yet, but yeah, I think it was definitely around then too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
And what kind of stuff does the photo sock do? I mean, I can't imagine it was the same since 1928, but
yeah, my role would have been king back then, because it's all film, right? That's all they had. But
yeah.
You know, now I'm just, you know, one of the side guys sometimes. Yeah, but we kind of just do everything. You know, we have what I have to tell people all the time every time they ask this question. We do workshops. We just had a DSLR workshop last week. Do photo walks. We got one gonna just push some of these events, I guess. Photo walk the 27th.
What's a photo walk?
It's just this one we're just gonna be walking around campus taking pictures, basically. That's
cool.
About it. Yeah. We also have a Halloween photo booth for people who wanna check that out.
Get spooky.
Yeah, exactly.
Great.
What else? Yeah, and then we kind of just provide a lot of services to people, mm-hmm. like the dark room and studio. We lend out a lot of equipment. We have a couple DSLRs or something. So, you know, anybody who's listening who wants into that, then be a good $30.
Right, it is a good $30 spend. I'll say that.
Yeah.
Tell me about your own photo practice. How did you get involved with photography?
Yeah, it was really. Weird and arbitrary, kind of I started I just picked up my parents' point and shoot in grade 9 or something, and I started taking pictures of it. You know, some of them were okay. Some of them were quite artful. Yeah, and then that kind of stopped because I was kind of more interested in like writing at that time. And then like once grade 12 kind of rolled around, I kind of got like my grandparents had their old film cameras and I kind of got them. And then, I was really interested in using them and I did. And it just really hooked me into, film photography and photography in general. And like, and then I was like, I guess like most people, you know, you get interested in just kind of like doing the kind of walking around, taking pictures of things. And like, I guess I always found that interesting in like that kind of documentary practice. Mm-hmm. And as you know, I'm interested in like the issues with documentary practices, like the ethics of it or like what narratives are being told like that. So I think, I've tried to move my work in that kind of more conceptual framework, I'd say,
That's been over the past 2 years.
Yeah, it's been the past, I don't know. I've been trying to make more work, in the past year, I guess, more like for a while I was in like a kind of slump because I guess I didn't have a purpose in a sense or something like that. So stuff I was interested in. So yeah, it's about like maybe those kind of questions have been coming up like the past year or so, something like that.
Do you feel like it's film that's kind of as that medium specifically and the materiality of it that helped you kind of get over that slump, or have you always been interested in film?
Yeah, I've always been interested in film. I don't know why. Maybe I'm just contrarian or something, but it's like, I've always been interested in like even like, you know, like you could say there's no reason to do it now with like digital and stuff, but like a lot of even like contemporary like photography practitioners, they still use film, and I think there's still like qualities to it and things you can do with it too that I think are still prescient mm-hmm. like nowadays, like you saw like my I guess it's the part where we describe photographs over sound, right? Like you saw my I'm working on this houseboy project, as you know, about these Chinese immigrants in early 20th century Vancouver who had to work in as houseboys for like white families and the kind of the troubles they kind of got into and kind of some scandalous situations that happened around that. And so like and that I was kind of interested in like the visibility of these sort of like marginalized figures in history, like you don't hear people talking about that as much. So like that thing you saw, the where I made these pictures with pictures with houseboys on photo paper, and then I put glass over it, so you'd see the lines of the glass as they were exposed on the photo paper, creating these kind of abstract grids. To me, it was like a way of having these layers and having this kind of abstract, unreadable form over these more, readable historical pictures that aren't, very well known about this part of history that's not seen, that's covered up and that kind of stuff.
Right. It's a dialogue with the archive. I mean,
yeah, exactly. You know. That too. Like that's the other, that's the other thing. Totally. The archive interesting thing about documentary photography, photography is documented so much. And, these pictures get kind of, stuffed around the place, like in the archives, right? But, they're there, but you don't know about them because they're just sitting there, kind of,
What was the photo from kind of your exploration in the archive that first struck you about the houseboy and this idea and this role that they were playing?
Yeah, it was kind of like the first one I saw in this book called Saltwater City, which is it's by Paul Yi, I think. It's like a illustrated history to the Chinese in Vancouver, and there is this picture of a house. Like a lot of these pictures, they had like the pictures of the family and the houseboy just kind of standing there, and in this picture is really this house play really appeared like a kind of specter, like a kind of, you know, the specter of history. And I'm sure they were, you know, people who, you know, they were house labor, you know, they're not meant to be seen, of course. They just do the work in the background. And I guess that's also compounded by the fact that, you know, the racialized aspect too. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of that too, just this, you know, this thing that's unseen but still has presence in a way, but we choose not to see it, or we bury it behind other things, that kind of stuff, you mm-hmm. know.
And what was some of the scandalous things?
Well, like they got involved with? Yeah, there's this pretty famous murder mystery in like 1920s where this Scottish housemaid named Janet Smith was found murdered in her family's house, the family she works for house, and then. The blame kind of, first people said it was just like a suicide because there are these debaucherous things going up with his family. And then eventually, like, that, I guess I wasn't good enough for people. So then eventually, of course, like, blame came on to the Chinese houseboy who also worked for that family alongside Janet Smith. And the real terrible thing is that they, you know, members of the police, some like government officials too, I think, they basically kidnapped this houseboy, and they they tortured him. Basically, they tried to get a confession. So it's that. So there's that really dark history there. That's like, I mean, it seems pretty famous. Apparently, like mm-hmm. it's called the Janet Smith case and everything. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just you don't hear about it.
What is it? I mean, aside from the role of the photograph in archives and in crime photography, what is it about the medium that makes it so appropriate for representing and for thinking about these sort of issues?
Yeah, I think it's, to me, it's like, oh, geez, it's from Alan Sekula had such a great line about this. Like, actually, from I took out photography against the grain,
right,
from Irving.
Fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic.
And I had this really good line about just exactly this. Mm. I don't remember what it was. But anyway, for me, it's just kind of like, you know, it's the whole paradox with photography. Supposed documentary value, you know, because it realistically depicts the real, you know, how we see, like, the world and such.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, though, that's... pretty much mere illusion. And like, you know, like, it's, you know, this came up in my art history class today, you know, how that hides other stuff, or, you know, points to other things that the photograph doesn't necessarily want to point to,
right?
Like certain, like like in the class today, we had this picture where it was a picture with Shirley Temple, and she was next to this Chinese lady in Vancouver's Chinatown, because there's this Chinese lady who was like a pageant queen, kind of.
Okay.
And like, so my professor was saying, like, how, you know, it's strange, like, the symbol of white America, you know, in Chinatown here, when Chinese people were obviously not being treated very well. This was around like the 30s.
Right.
And like, so yeah, like that, like this kind of nice, I don't know, publicity kind of photograph, pointing to, you know, other tensions and other things that the photograph doesn't want to say. And
mm-hmm.
that's a really intriguing thing about just seeing photographs too. So I think, yeah, I guess Alan Sekula was just saying, like, it's, you know, like, photographs pointing to social histories that you don't see in the photographs. So it's probably something like that, you know.
Oh, what essay is it from? I mean,
think it's from the very first one in the book. It's okay. From, you know, aptly titled The Creation of Photographic Meaning, I think.
Right.
Yeah, and he's like, yeah, he does some good stuff in it, because he's talking about, like, this one photographer, like, Lewis Hine, who was a big, like, social reformist in the early 1900s in America, and he took a lot of pictures of, immigrants and, like, child laborers in an attempt for reform. And, you know, Alan Sekula goes on in the essay about how, yeah, photographs gain, like, meaning by being placed into a discourse. And so, like, the discourse around this, like, this photograph he talks about, which is called Immigrants Walking Off a Gangplank, like, it's just a very mundane kind of picture of, yeah, these two women immigrants just walking off the gangplank of a ship. But of course, it's, you know, for someone like Hines, like this picture might have been published in like kind of like social reform magazines or something. So it's like photographs just kind of go beyond their mundanity sometimes and are so easily imbued with meaning. And I think that's the whole like really fascinating thing about it. You know?
I mean, one thing that I've always loved about Alan Sequoyah is the way that he's able to marry, you know, his criticism and his writing on photography along with an actual photographic practice. How do you feel about, you were talking before about how when you started photography, it was kind of contending with writing as well, and it was held up against writing, and it, you know, it had a relationship with that. How do you think about the relationship now? In your own life, I guess.
Yeah, it wasn't... I've always wondered why I went from, like, the textual to the visual kind of. I don't know. Maybe... There's always, like, an interesting tension, of course. Like, with Alan Sekulak, with his photo essays in Photography Against the Grain, like, kind of using photographs as, like, captions, like how they're classically used, but also using them to reveal the power structures that the photograph can't just show you.
Right.
So maybe I felt like the visual can be more ambiguous and that maybe it can say more, possibly, and that's... Yeah, I can't say so much yet about their kind of reciprocal relationship, maybe, but I suppose I feel drawn towards the visual because there's so much... Yeah, there's just so much, like, meaning sometimes put around the photograph. There's so much you can take out sometimes, yeah.
How do you feel about, I mean, there's the photo stock, which kind of gives an education, in a sense, a photographic education. Yeah. And then you're also studying photography here at UBC. How do you feel about, you know, approaching photography in an academic setting and that kind of training?
Yeah, like the whole art school thing, I guess.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's like, sometimes I felt like if you want to be working as an artist, like, you kind of have to go through that whole going for art school thing. Yeah. I mean, from the photography classes I've taken at UBC, they've been really nice. And, you know, it's good having, like, the projects, like, the assignments they give you to work on, like, certain projects, like that white settler photographer thing they sent you. So that's really cool. I mean, there's more, like, institutional things we could talk about, I guess, like, I don't know.
Maybe just returning real quick to that. Yeah. Let's get some more descriptions of photography in here. Returning to that white settler photography and the idea of shooting photography on campus at UBC.
Right.
Describe this photo series for me, or describe one photo for me.
So basically, I dressed up as your typical 19th century gentleman with a nice coat, a ridiculous top hat, which is like, I don't know, that thing probably rose like 5 feet maybe.
A very big,
very, very tall top hat, ridiculous. And so like, it was like contending with kind of like, again, with documentary photography, like how it was used around the time of photography's creation, like starting like mid 19th century. Like the obvious colonial use of it, like these European photographers going out to the colonies and like taking pictures there, bringing back, you know, exotic views to people back in the mother country. And so I was like, I mean, that one had text. I guess we can talk about that. Like the text with that, I guess was interesting. It was to help like kind of add on to the whole, you know, ridiculousness too of this whole, like, to really kind of flesh out this character I wanted to explore, this 19th century photographer and the kind of worldview they would have of, like, you know, maybe not totally understanding what they were seeing, but thought they were because they could take the photograph of it and just kind of hold it. with them. So, yeah, and of course, like, the UBC campus is obviously, all of Vancouver is a contended space. So, like, right. working in this mode, this kind of performative mode, like, on UBC is, yeah, there's a lot in that.
There is, sure, yeah. 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 I think that's a great place to end, Brandon. Okay. Thank you so
Sounds
much.
Yeah.
What song do you, tell me a bit about this song that's about okay. to set us off. I'm very excited.
I've been in love with disco for a while now, and then the Japanese seem to make some of the best disco and funk around, honestly. So right. this is, are you going to play it? Like
I'm getting ready.
Like faded in, okay.
I've been faded in, yeah.
So this just popped up on my YouTube, like feed, I guess, last night, and it's from this super, just really bombastic theme from this, I guess, this Japanese, like, hard-boiled cop show from the 80s, a super, like, yeah. cheesy, like, badass TV, like, cop show with, you know, the classic, you know, like, funk, yeah, you can hear it right now.
Oh, this yeah.
Classic funk, you know,
grooves.
Yeah, grooves, exactly. Yeah, it's just so great.
Textbook, CITR, yeah. 101.9, broadcasting live from Unceded Coast Salish Territories. Thank you so much, Ben.
Great, thanks.
you're so sad?
Oh, nothing, really.
Not very convincing, Jane girl. Whatever it is, I've got just the cure for it.
One, two, three, four.
Did you know CITR has a women's collective? This brand new collective is all about providing and fostering a community for women who are or who want to be in radio, fighting the gender disparity in media, and centering women's voices and issues. If you are a female-identified person or ally who's already involved in radio or wants somewhere to start, this collective is for you. Email womenscollective@citr.ca for more information and to get involved. And tune in Friday at 6 p.m. for the collective show, Lady Radio, featuring music, interviews, events, news, commentary, basically anything we care to talk about. See you then.
Well, how do you like it?
There's only one word for it. Terrific. You know, I'm so proud of it. It's almost indecent.
Noah from Christ on Parade, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, BC, Canada.
Hello there. This is Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Coast Salish territory, UBC, Vancouver. My name is Josh. This is a show about stories and about student life and whatever else I feel like talking about. I'm here with Claire and Michael. Claire and Michael, do you want to introduce yourself? I'm also going to throw back on the Mad Police 1979 soundtrack. I'm just going to keep it at a low volume. So, Claire, introduce yourself.
Hey, how's it going?
Claire, what? How was your day?
It was pretty good. I had a midterm.
Great.
And other than that, didn't do too much.
I live with Claire. Claire's my roommate. Full disclosure. Michael, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm good.
Great. Michael is a student here. He's in his last semester. Mm-hmm. Michael is sitting in on this little story we're going to have, but he's also going to talk a little bit later in the show about paper writing and grad school application.
Sure.
And that sounds way more dry than it's actually going to be. It's actually going to be very exciting.
If you're into either of those things, maybe.
If you're into, we're not walking you through grad school application, but just talking about that and what that means. But first, Claire has some photos here to talk about. This is the photo show today, at least in some part, it's the photo show. Claire, tell me about these. Tell me about the first photo that you have for us here. Describe it for me.
The one on the left.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a group of what looks like students, or I know is students, and they're sitting on the floor of a room that is seemingly filled with bunk beds, and they're sort of peering out over a map and kind of planning out what their weekend's going to look like.
And who is in this photo, Claire?
This is a photo of a group of friends that I met in first and second year, and we sort of formed a tradition of going on trips for Thanksgiving, kind of creating new traditions since all of us were pretty far from home and couldn't have a traditional Thanksgiving. And that year we decided to go down to Portland, and we didn't really have much of a plan. We just booked a hostel and rented a minivan, and six friends drove down to Portland, and it kind of unfolded into a wonderful weekend with random adventures. Full disclosure, Josh and Michael were both on this weekend trip.
We're both in this picture. We're talking about it as if it's some distant photo. But
I'm being vague for no reason.
What was going on this day, though? I don't remember anything about this photo.
Oh, my gosh. This photo, I actually picked it because it brings back the memory of a specific story that took place in this room, which was Josh, as per usual, had a lot of work to do. And so he was staying up late working one night, and it was only our first night in the hostel. And we sort of hadn't even spent a night there yet, so we're still getting comfortable in a new city and didn't really know what the trip was going to look like. And we had bought beers earlier in the evening, and we brought them back, and we didn't even crack into any of them. They were just sitting beside our bed. And I, we had all gone to bed except you, Josh. You were still up and you were working late on an essay. And you got up to go to the washroom, I believe, at one point, and you left the door ajar. And I was awoken.
I didn't have a key to get back in.
You didn't have a key to get back in. No blame. No blame. Yeah. You left the door ajar, and I was on the bottom bunk, kind of sleeping right next to the beers, which were sort of mixed in with my stuff. And all I remember was all of a sudden there was a noise, and I looked over, and there was a man who I didn't recognize. I was living with both you and Michael at that time. And I was very familiar with you guys, and I was like, I don't know this person. And there was this man right next to me, and he was rummaging through my things. And I kind of went into like fight or flight mode, and I sat up, and I was like, what are you doing? And that was sort of when you came back into the room too, and it became this like sort of like hostile 3 a.m. crisis situation.
Yeah, middle of the night.
Middle of the night. And then, as it turned out, he ended up being someone who was working for the hostel, and supposedly we weren't allowed to have
the desk was right outside of our room.
Exactly.
And I think he'd peered into the room. Was that the?
He had peered in, and he had noticed there were beers, and we were in a public hostel, so even though there were six of us and we actually were fully occupying the public dormitory in a private sense, but it was normally a public dormitory and you're not supposed to have alcohol in public dormitories and hostels, I think, as a general rule. And so he was diligently doing his job. And but it was just the weirdest thing because, like, there was no possibility of us waking up between 3 and 8 a.m. to drink those beers. We were all sound asleep. So it was just a very like intrusive experience and kind of set this weird note to the beginning of the trip. And I remember at least feeling like a bit like jittered.
Yeah. It was
That's
weird.
That's not a word, but.
No. Michael's nodding his head. What was this guy like?
I completely forgot this happened until the part about finding the beers that I don't know if I woke up for it.
You did wake up, and you thought it was just not a big deal. And I remember so frustrated with you because I was like, this is a big deal. Like I don't know. I just thought it was such an invasion of privacy to make someone feel that uncomfortable by coming into your room.
In the middle of the night.
But the funniest part isn't that. The funniest part is the next night we went to a party at Reed College, kind of. And that's sort of what the second photo, actually, that I brought in.
Yeah. Describe this one.
This is a photo of me.
It's an action shot.
It's an action shot that someone took, and I didn't know there was a photo being taken because I don't normally dance like I did that evening. But, it's a photo of me dancing, and you can see the back of another girl's head, and, like, everyone's kind of in movement. And we sort of ended up at this Reed College party, which was a really...
Reed College being, like, one of the zaniest liberal arts schools in the United States. Also, like, $80,000 a year or something crazy like that. It's like, a really expensive
$8,000.
80.
80.
It's,
80,
like,
80,
40 80. Or 80. It's, like, really, really high.
Do you know how many students go there?
It's really small. But the students that come out of there are very... Right, it has a weird, weird curriculum, and it was a weird party.
It was a weird party. Yeah. And I remember just, like, everyone at the party also being unique and very interesting characters. And at some point during this party, we ended up in the basement where the sound system was, and we sort of
somehow... A pretty dungeon-y basement.
A very dungeon-y basement, yeah. And we ended up kind of taking over the sound system and playing a bunch of music. And we had a really fun night, but the funny part, tying back to the first story, was that night you had kind of this confrontation with the employee who had sort of, in a way...
He was a mean dude.
He was kind of aggressive, and he wasn't very friendly or apologetic that he had made sort of me and I think a few of the other girls we were on the trip with feel quite uncomfortable coming into the dormitory late at night. And then the next, and you had kind of confronted him and said, hey, that was really not cool.
Yeah.
And the next night we got back from this party a little bit drunk, and you ran into the guy coming up the stairs, and he was very intimidated by you because you had, I guess, given him a hard time. And I think his boss had spoken with him as well because we had sort of lodged a complaint. And then you promptly after walking by him and kind of giving him a dirty look, proceeded to try your key card on the door to get into your dormitory room, except wasn't your dormitory room at all. And so I was standing behind you going, Josh, Josh.
I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, you were a bit...
I'm glad I didn't have any serious confrontation with them.
No, nothing, yeah. Nothing like that. But it was just you had the upper hand initially in that confrontation.
And then I lost
and
it
then you completely
quick.
Lost yeah. it after.
So tell me more about this dancing. I really like this dancing photo because there's a lot of kinetic energy here. Everybody's going around in a circle. It's a dancing circle, and there's limbs flying.
Yeah, from what I remember, I mean, you guys can step in and correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I remember, we took over the sound system and then started playing kind of whatever we wanted and maybe in our minds better music. And there were a few comments about the change in music, and we sort of responded to it by getting really into dancing. And so we were forming these like circles and jumping around, like almost cult-like.
The more
we got into it, the more people just accepted it as the thing that was happening, and more people were joining, sort of without
zanying them,
without questioning it. And I don't know, you guys have your own memories of that.
I remember being a good party, but pretty yeah. I think the best thing about this party was that everybody left
yeah,
at the end to go to...
Well, in stages throughout the parties.
Yeah.
They left.
As the night went on.
Just for context, at the end of the night, the house was empty, and it was only the six of us sitting on a couch, and everybody else had left, but they had left in stages, and every single person who left this house, I think, proclaimed...
that they were leaving to go to the Naked Tree.
Which was a time-tested tradition.
Time-tested tradition of Reed that we were well aware
where everybody
of.
Got naked around this tree, which just didn't seem like a
yeah.
good idea.
And it was like a declaration as everyone left. Yeah. It was like to the Naked Tree.
Yeah. Claire, I also really like this photo because it reminds me of a painting and a poem you told me about. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yesterday when you asked me to look through my photos and pick out a few photos and describe them on air, we were kind of joking that was like a funny concept because it's weird to describe a photo that you can't see. But I was saying it reminded me of a poem that we were just working on in one of my classes, which the poem is written about a painting, and it gives the painting that is so full of life kind of life again, because the painting is it's painting, it's still, it's not moving, but it's of a dance, and through the poem it becomes like this huge festivity and it adds to it. And so I just thought that was interesting because I knew that if I were to describe a photo on the radio, it wouldn't be exactly what I was looking at. The photo still, you can't, well, you can tell that we're dancing, but it's frozen, and like you said, it's when you look at it and you know sort of the story behind it, you see so much more than that. And mm-hmm. So in describing it, you're giving it like a lot of
giving
life.
It a new life, yeah,
like yeah.
Michael, did you know that Claire was in Montreal last week?
I did, yeah. I heard she went home for Thanksgiving. Yeah. She actually brought a bag home for me, which is really nice of her, because I'm starting the process of getting all my things back home.
Because you graduated.
Because
I've,
yeah,
oh my
because
God,
I've
really?
Kind of,
bring it back
over
to
the
Montreal.
Years, brought more things here than I've taken, so I'm kind of lopsided. Yeah.
So you took a bag to...
I took a snowboard.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He asked me to bring a bag and then gave me a snowboard. It was a bold decision.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm just teasing you.
Claire, how's Montreal? Do you have any stories to tell us from Montreal?
I don't know. Montreal was good. It's actually funny that I'm talking about Thanksgiving. This is the first Thanksgiving that I've been home for in the last 4 years. Normally, I wouldn't go home for Thanksgiving, but I did this year, which was really nice. Thanksgiving in Quebec and in the East Coast is quite different than here.
Do you find?
Yeah, the whole vibe. Actually, Tom, one of our friends, came with us, and he grew up out west, and he said, this is... like what every West Coast kid dreams Thanksgiving would be like it's like what you would see on TV.
Extravagant.
A lot of
cranberry sauce.
I think they have cranberry sauce here too.
Claire, do you have a song to send us off with?
Yeah, sure. I asked you, I think, to put on Will Butler's song, Anna.
Great. I like this because it's a good CanCon track. Will Butler being from Montreal, of course. So here's Anna by Will Butler. Will Butler from Arcade Fire. Claire, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM. It's Tuesday. It's a gray and rainy day out here at UBC. I'm here with Michael. Michael,
hey, how's it going?
So before Michael, we were talking about pictures and dancing and fun stuff, and now we're just going to go really dry conversation.
Nice.
Over to grad school. It's not going to be that dry. What I wanted to talk to you about in the first place was the process of going back to papers that you've done. This is part of the segment, Tell Me About Your Paper, mm-hmm. talking about papers, talking about style and writing papers and what that means, and the fact that you only have really one person ever reading your paper, or in this case, maybe you have a ton of like graduate program admissions reading your paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
And how are you dealing with revising old papers? Are you still doing the paper that you said you were going to be doing?
I believe so, yeah. So for context, I'm applying to philosophy graduate school, and I'm not, so everything I can have to say about the process and the prospects and everything kind of going on with graduate school is really about philosophy graduate school.
We're not doctors here. We can't give any medical advice.
I assume it's similar for other humanities programs and other arts programs or kind of writing-based programs. But for philosophy, at least, the most important part of your application is almost certainly your writing sample. And so that's like a 20, 25-page paper. And that's kind of worth more than your grades, worth more than your letters of rec, worth more than your GREs. So it's kind of, I think it's a good thing because I think it is the clearest, representation of your abilities, whereas grades can be,
inflated
or deflated, yeah. depending on where you go to school. It's also, very hard to tell, it kind of limits how much, judgment of the overall school's prestige is put in, to, analyzing and evaluating your application.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's hard to know, you know, is an 80 from UBC the same as an 80 from Princeton? And they might say, no, an 80 from Princeton is more impressive for whatever,
right?
Whether that's wrong or not. But if you just have two papers, you just have two papers.
You yeah. can just, and you just judge yeah. on ability.
Same as letters of reference. I mean, because letters of reference, they're judging your ability relative to your classmates' ability. And so at least it's plausible that that's right. harder to do at Princeton than UBC. And harder to do it at UBC than maybe a community college.
Right. So you wrote this paper over the summer.
Yeah, I wrote this. I took a directed reading, or I kind of created a directed reading course this summer, which is a really cool option that I think most departments offer at UBC, and not many people know about it. But basically, you can create your own course and do it alone. And you just need to find a professor who will do it with you, although that is the hard part. That's not just this extra part. Finding a professor who's willing to kind of put in the time to do a whole course just with one person. And it's really meant to be like self-directed studying. So you're kind of planning the syllabus. And but it's a really great opportunity. I mean, you can really just study what you want to study, which is pretty
right.
Rare in other things.
And you were tree planting while you
Yeah, that was somewhat of a ridiculous idea.
How is it ridiculous?
Because I had to make money this summer, but it was also the only time I could get anyone agree to do a directed reading, because during the semester it just takes up too much time from the profs research and their main teaching courses. But I was able to do one over the summer, but I also needed to make money over the summer, so I decided that I would do it at the same time as tree planting. And I went tree planting last summer, and I was able to read like quite a lot, you know, 2 or 3 hours a day. So I said, you know what, I'll just spend that 2 or 3 hours a day reading for this philosophy course and writing. But it turns out it's a lot harder to write under little sleep and being incredibly tired than it is to read.
Right. And where were you tree planting?
I was, we were moving all over the place, but in kind of central to western Canada, Saskatchewan, Alberta, Manitoba. We were kind of running from the fires all summer.
Right. Where was your reading spot? Was it in the ashes or was it in the truck? Or
there was a few in the morning. It was at kind of a deserted corner of the mess tent. This is 6 a.m. before we go planting.
Really, wow.
Big coffee. And then on the way to the block, which is where we plant, it was in the truck. And then after, it was, I would also usually go in the truck because it was like quiet and warm when we were back at camp at night.
And, yeah, the warmth is always really important, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, like, the weather was what? You got crickets out there. Set the scene for me. You got some crickets. You got some, maybe it's a little wet on the ground from the
yeah,
rain.
Yeah, we had a lot. It's bizarre because it was the summer of fires, even though it was way wetter than last summer, for us at least. I guess the dry periods before we came, but it was muddy. Like my books were going pretty destroyed, but dirt and mud, which wasn't fun.
And then you started working on this paper. This was the final paper for the course?
Yeah, so most, I mean, at least in humanities, most directed readings, you would kind of plan them so that you can just write kind of one big paper, and often just like responses along the way, and then one big paper. Yeah, and so it was a paper on, basically the course was on kind of genealogy and critical theory, and genealogy is a critical practice. And so the big kind of the philosopher genealogists are Nietzsche and Foucault. So I read a lot, and the prof I was doing it with was a Foucault scholar primarily. So that was great.
Mm-hmm. And were you... I know also you didn't treat plant the whole summer. So did you start the paper before you left, or?
Yeah, I had to write a proposal for it just before I left, in the last kind of week before I left, but I ended up changing my plan quite a lot.
What was the process like for writing that proposal, though? Just in the truck? Like?
Yeah, I mean, well, I was writing responses the whole time, too. So, yeah, in the truck at night, really tired, sometimes in the tent.
How are you getting Wi-Fi?
No Wi-Fi. Writing on Microsoft Word. Oh, the Wi-Fi was actually the biggest stress all summer, because you'd be in a lot of quite remote places without any reception. And so it was always usually while we were driving and on a highway, we'd get some kind of reception, and I would try to make a hotspot with my phone and connect for like 3 minutes to like receive an email from my prof, send one back. And that's how I sent in all my responses.
Crazy. And so... you send off this proposal, and then you do away with tree planting.
Yeah, yeah. I went home towards middle of July.
Right.
And then I could focus more on the paper. Although it also felt like my only part of like real summer break, so it
was writing this paper
for other reasons.
And so you're writing this paper, you're back in Montreal, you submit this paper, it comes out. And how were you feeling about it? You were like, I remember you being pretty stoked on this paper.
I was really excited about it. When I wrote it, revisiting it, I think it's probably normal. I had a weird sense, I was quite critical of it, and I didn't like it when I reread it, and I didn't.
This is rereading it like 2 months after.
Yeah.
3 months after.
Yeah. Which, I mean, is not something we normally do in undergrad. Right. Of course, in academia in general, that's the most normal thing in the world, is to go back and reread your old papers and improve on them and rethink your old arguments. But yeah, I was finding, I couldn't pinpoint what it was I didn't like about it. And so it was kind of hard to work on it, because it was just kind of this general dissatisfaction without being like, okay, I really don't like my argument here.
Right.
I'm not being clear here. It was just kind of, it was a bit too general. And then, I'm sorry, I mean, like, I'm trying to kind of rework it, refine it, and polish it. And so now I'm trying to look at in specific parts just to kind of make that easier myself.
And are you for sure going with this paper? Because that's also the other thing, is choosing a paper that's like, this is it.
Yeah, so that's... I mean, the stress, that's a really important decision, although there's no super easy way to make it. I mean, you need most of the papers you write in class are only, you know, 2,000, maybe 3,000 words, and this needs to be like a 5,000 or 6,000 word paper. And so even with those papers, when you're looking over an old kind of end of term paper, it's hard to know, like, will this work out if I kind of have to double it? I have to put twice as much content in it, or this is a paper that works at 3,000 words. So right now my plan is to kind of try to refine this one as much as possible, and if it doesn't work, use paper from a seminar I'm writing this seminar. But I'm definitely hoping this paper, I mean, like, the more you talk, I talk to profs and read kind of advice online, it's just everyone's just like really stressing getting one paper as perfect as possible.
It's really polished,
and not kind of, if you're stuck between two papers, just choose one and kind of go all at it, because you really need it to be your best work.
How's your view on writing changed since you got to university?
Well, I mean, it's,
or I mean, throughout it's kind the of past three
only
four
developed
years.
In university,
yeah.
And changed. But I mean, one thing I could say, especially, well, maybe with we were talking about this earlier this week, I know, and with reference to this paper is just, I mean, everyone's always telling you write clearly, and I'm sure that still hasn't kind of sunk in. It's just so incredibly important to how you write. And
right.
As I go back to this paper, I'm especially noticing it because, I mean, this is kind of idiosyncratic to philosophy, but Foucault and Nietzsche are kind of put in this camp of philosophers called continental philosophers, and they're kind of infamous for having a very kind of complicated, convoluted, unclear, poetic, flowery, excessive writing style, which a lot of people think is just impenetrable because there's some kind of, like, I don't know, people go further than that with criticism, but it really is a big criticism just of the writing style. And so when I was in that and I was reading it, you end up really writing like what you're reading, and you use the same terms, and, like, they kind of, you know, they might be using the terms in kind of a skewed way or an angled way, and then you kind of start developing that, and you kind of take that for granted. But now, after taking a few months off and going back to reading what we mostly read in, like, North American philosophy departments, which is just really kind of analytic, rigorous, concise, simple, and kind of brutally clear writing, it's making me realize kind of those what some would say my mistakes of kind of following kind of Foucauldian way of writing, and so I think that's kind of nice. Now I'm trying to attack it and kind of make it more analytic, but yeah, no, clear writing, I totally just think it leads to clear thinking.
I remember writing some just god awful papers at the beginning where I was just throwing words around,
yeah,
and trying to make them stick on the wall.
Yeah, yeah, kind of the idea that there was time we were kind of knowingly writing things that we knew didn't really make sense,
right?
And or just trying to fill space like that. It's now that seems just so absurd that we would ever, like, knowingly, because, like, the biggest fear is that happens accidentally, that you don't realize that you're just filling space and that you don't need to say what you're saying. It's definitely improved. And, like, getting rid of any kind of illusions that writing with big words is better writing necessarily.
Right.
Which I'm sure plagues every kind of first year.
I'm always really worried that I get too fixated on some, yeah, like you're saying, too fixated on some small point that just doesn't need to be there.
Yeah,
some
definitely.
Point that gets you really
it was
excited.
The kill the darlings thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, kill the darlings.
Yeah. Yeah, it's often, I was thinking about, it's often those parts are so nice, and it's almost because they're inconsequential to the actual work of your argument or your analysis that they're nice, because they kind of stand alone and they're not really going to be critiqued like the rest of your argument will. And so they can just be this kind of pretty nice point that you've made on the side.
Right, that you hope will.
And maybe it was actually a part of your argument you would realize is actually not that
yeah.
nice. But because you kind of, you as both the reader and, like, imagining the future evaluator looking at it, being not taking it as essential.
Yeah, absolutely. Michael, thank you so much for coming in today. I really
yeah,
appreciate
my pleasure.
Talking.
Nice,
we'll,
nice
have, we'll for sure hear you again on this show. This was Textbook CITR 101.9. Next up is Discorder Radio. Before that, I'm going to play you a little ad. So thank you so much for being with me today. CITR 101.9 FM.
Do you find sports distracting? Feel the need to chant sports for hours on end? Then come on by the CITR station at the new sub to get involved. We do play-by-play, color commentary, audio production, interviews, and so much more. Only on CITR 101.9 FM. Ladies and gentlemen.